Professor Funner, wait, can everyone hear me? Okay?
Yeah.
Professor Funner, who was Louis Napoleon?
First, before answering that, let me just thank everybody for coming. It's great to see so many people who are here who are not obligated to register for a class or being paid to come, I don't think. And thanks to David Marcus for getting me down here.
Yeah, and to Natasha for sending all the emails.
And I see a few familiar faces of former students and current students, so it's great to... Anyway, all right, Louis Napoleon. In this book, which is about the Underground Railroad in New York City, as was said, one of the things that I found very fascinating about writing it was sort of discovering people who were completely unknown to me and to most of the historical literature. Louis Napoleon was a black man born in New York City in 1800. If you really know New York State history, you will know that being born in 1800 meant that he was born after the passage of the Gradual Emancipation Act of 1799. He was born to a slave mother, but it meant that at age 25 he would become free after serving a long apprenticeship for his mother's owner. Anyway, so he did it. He became free in the 1820s. And he became what you might call the sort of point person on the streets of what is called the Underground Railroad. I use that term, it's unavoidable and it's useful, but one shouldn't think of it as some giant network of highly organized routes and stations and codes and tunnels. Every time I lecture about this, people come up to me, there's a tunnel leading from this old housing. No, forget it, slaves are not going around the tunnels. It had nothing to do with the Underground Railroad. But anyway, Napoleon was on the streets. He scoured the docks. He went to the docks and met right around here. Yeah, the East River docks, and met slaves who had stowed away on ships coming, with thousands of ships going up and down the Atlantic coast. And some ship owners, without being anti-slavery, were willing to take money from slaves to hide a few on their ship and drop them off in New York. And when they did, Louis Napoleon was out there looking for them. Or people who came up on the railroad. At that time, the railroad from the south stopped in Perth Amboy, basically, New Jersey, and then they had to take a ferry over to Manhattan, and Louis Napoleon was there to meet them. So this is, now, I'd never heard of Louis Napoleon. He was really a guy on the streets helping fugitive slaves. He was illiterate. I was shocked eventually to discover that, because in the papers of Columbia, which I used, there were little receipts with signed by an X, with an X, by Louis Napoleon. But he also was able to go to court and get writs of habeas corpus to rescue slaves who were captured in New York. And my final thing about him is that in one famous case, famous to us, the Napoleon v. Lemon, which was actually a very important legal case in the 1850s, where a slave owner from Virginia brought a whole bunch, seven or eight slaves and his family. He was trying to move to Texas, but you couldn't get to Texas from Virginia without coming to New York and getting a boat to Texas. But at that time, it was illegal to bring slaves into New York anymore. And Napoleon found out these slaves were here. They're not fugitives. They were brought there by the owner. And he got a writ of habeas corpus. They came, and the judge freed them all, about seven or eight of them. And it was appealed, et cetera, et cetera. And in one of the appeals, the lawyer from Virginia asked the lawyer John Jay II, a graduate of Columbia, by the way, the abolitionist lawyer, who is this Louis Napoleon who brought this case? Is he the Emperor of France? And Jay said, no, he's a much better man. That was in the court records of New York State. So Napoleon, what is the point? Napoleon is an anonymous person, unknown to history, who actually played a very important role in the history of this city and in helping some number, there's no specific number, but some number of many hundreds, if not thousands, of slaves pass through New York City on their way to freedom in Canada.
Yeah, and the book is filled with people like Napoleon. Yeah. They don't have quite great anecdotes that Napoleon has, which is why I want to start with him. Mm-hmm. But still, this is a book that's filled with characters, and I think more than any of your other books, this is one that's driven by narrative. I wonder, what motivated that decision?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I just wanted people to read it. I think this book started in the opposite way than most books come. Most times you write a book, you try to write a book, and you start out with a question, a problem, an invitation. I mean, my book on Reconstruction, I wrote just because the editor of that series called me up and said, hey, we need a book on Reconstruction, would you like to do it? But, you know, all right, you get an idea. You get
10 years of your life later.
And then you figure out, well, what am I going to need to, what are the sources? Where am I going to do my research? This occurred the opposite way. Through a student at Columbia, actually, who was working on her senior thesis in the papers of an abolitionist called Sidney Howard Gay, 80 boxers of whose papers were at Columbia. She was also a dog walker, so I saw her a lot. She doesn't like to be, she's now a lawyer in New York, she doesn't like to be referred to just as a dog walker. But, you know, she said, you know, Professor, there's this document I came across, it's not really relevant, I'm interested in his journalistic career, so it's not relevant to me, but in box 72, there's this document about fugitive slaves, you might be interested. So one day I go, yeah, bring me box 72 here, what is it? And there were these two little, they're actually very small, two little notebooks, in which Gay kept a record. It's called The Record of Fugitives. For 2 years, 1855 and 56, he kept a record of over 200 men, women, and children, slaves, who passed through New York City, fugitive slaves. And being a journalist, he interviewed them. And so you get the voices through him of these people at the moment. There's a lot of stuff about the Underground Railroad written as memoirs later on, but those are, you know, not totally reliable. This is at the moment, people are in the midst of escaping. And he interviewed them, you know, who their owner, why did they run away, how did they run away, who helped them, all this kind of stuff. And I had never seen, and luckily, now, I don't claim to have discovered this, it's in the Columbia Library, but luckily our library is so poorly organized and indexed that nobody knew it was there. I had never seen any reference to it anywhere in any work of history.
This conversation brought to you by Columbia University.
And I decided I'm going to write something about this, and I, you know, it was these stories that really fascinated me, and these people, 90% of the people mentioned in that document disappear from history, but you can actually track down a little bit, you can find ads by their owners in the Baltimore Sun or Washington newspapers saying, hey, this guy has just escaped, reward, they give a description. You can find them, many of them, in the Canadian Census of 1861, living in Canada. So I tried to figure out as much as I could to tell the stories of these people who were, as I say, unknown to history up to this point. But also, like all my books, I think I try to deal with both levels. You know, it's both bottom up and top down. I talk about the congressional debates about fugitive slaves and the fugitive slave law and the politics of the coming of the Civil War, and then how the actions of how slave resistance, you might say, helps to contribute to the crisis which produces the Civil War. So I'm dealing with different levels at the same time. So yeah, as I was saying, the reviews that I like the best of this book are people who just said, you know, this book is like a novel. I couldn't put it down. That's unusual from anyone. I just read it all the way through. I could not put it down. It's so fascinating. So that it was a slightly different way of writing, but I got so interested in these stories that's how it turned out.
But one reason that you could write the political history of this, and this is something I was really surprised to find, is that, yeah, I mean, as you write in introduction, the Underground Railroad was a kind of quasi-public institution.
Right.
And, like, I mean, can you just explain how that worked, that these people are facilitating an illegal activity but doing it in public? Like you said, Gay's a journalist.
Yeah, well, first of all, when this book came out, I got an email. Don't put this in dissent, David, but I got an email from an old friend of mine who was, shall we say, in the 1970s, engaged in some less than legal activities. Rather stupid ones. But anyway, he's now above board and he's
in the
he was wanted back then. But anyway, you know, the thing that really struck me out of your book is that is the revelation that people can work both publicly and underground at the same time. He said, I wish I'd realized that back in the 1970s. And I thought to myself, I wish you'd realized that too. It would have saved a lot of people a lot of trouble. So yes, the Underground Railroad is part of the abolitionist movement. The people involved in it, and by the way, there were very few people involved in it. It wasn't this giant operation. In New York City, there were no more than a dozen people at any time actively engaged in helping fugitive slaves. You know, there was a literature going way back which sort of gives you a picture of this as a gigantic net. It wasn't. But nonetheless, those people were very active and quite successful, but they were also doing other things. Gay was editing an abolitionist newspaper. They were going to conventions. They were circulating petitions. They were giving speeches. In New York, it was pretty secret what they were doing, because this was a, you know, the thing that has surprised people, even though it's hardly new, is that New York City was a very pro-Southern town. It was completely tied into the Cotton South economically. This was, you know, this was shown by my uncle Philip Foner before I was born. In 1941, he published Business and Slavery, still a very, very valuable book about New York merchants and the Cotton South. Some people, since it's the same last name, think I wrote that book. I have done many things, but writing a book before you were born is not something I've accomplished yet. But anyway, so it's, you know, it's secret and not secret. That's the key point. People knew, you know, one of the things that's very important to me in this book is, like, ordinary people. When I say there's a dozen people, there's a lot of other people who know what to do. There are black dock workers. There are black people working in hotels. There are black people working in people's homes as domestic workers. And they know what to do if they meet a slave who wants to become free. They see a guy on a ship. They know to go to Napoleon. They know to go to Sidney Howard Gay. So it's not exactly secret, but it's secret enough that it's not totally flamboyantly public. Whereas up in Syracuse, for example, a very anti-slave, it was completely public. The head of the Underground Railroad, they had a business card, which he just, he said, hey, I'm they call me Underground Railroad King, Jermaine Logan, himself a fugitive slave. Anybody sees a fugitive slave, send him to me. He put ads in the newspapers. He had fundraising parties at his house with fugitive slaves present. One of the guys mentioned in this Record of Fugitives by Sidney Howard, oh, by the way, if anyone here is teaching anywhere, we have now digitalized that and put up a transcript of it, and it's a wonderful document for showing students what the heck this all is about. It's just Google Gay Record of Fugitives. It's now up there. But, you know, so Logan, it was all open, but one of the guys mentioned in Gay's little thing of agents of the Underground Railroad was a guy named Ira Cobb in Syracuse. And I look him up in the census. He lives in the same sort of apartment building or housing complex with the sheriff of Syracuse. And he's hiding Underground Railroad. He's not a slave. The sheriff didn't care the slightest, obviously, you know. But in New York, it was a little different, and it was dangerous. And it wasn't that dangerous for Sidney Howard Gay, but it was very dangerous for fugitive slaves. There were slave catchers roaming the streets of New York all the way up to the Civil War. And, you know, according to the, and here's a pre-law lawyer, the common law of recaption, an owner has a perfect right to just grab a fugitive and haul him off with no legal process whatsoever. And there were people who did that. They'd grab people on the street, take them to a boat, off they go. Yeah. Never going to a sheriff, nothing, a judge. You couldn't do it if you created a breach of the peace. And that became more and more, there were people who resisted, and therefore the law had to get involved. But, you know, so it's quite a fascinating story. And it, you know, they were operating both overground and underground at the same time. Yes.
Just on the subject of this danger that people will face, like, one thing I was struck by was, I had always assumed that if you're a fugitive slave, that you, like, escape to the north, or, like, you get captured and it's over. But you have these stories of people, for instance, one of your characters, like, spends 13 months, like, living in the woods, and he's, like, surrounded by animals, and he's, like, fending for himself, and he said the only thing he was afraid of was, like, being found by another man.
That was a great quote. He said to Gay, I was in the woods for 13 months, snakes, bears. The only thing I feared was man, he said. So, you know, he was afraid of being recounted.
But this is something that links, like, all the characters in this book, and actually, in a way, Lincoln in your last book, is that these are people who are trying to affect political change and actually manage to achieve something. So it's actually, these are, like, quite optimistic stories at a time when it seems like among historians generally, like for this period even, that just like pessimism is more important.
Yeah, well, you know, I, as you well know, I am retiring from teaching pretty soon, at the end of next academic year. Although he's going to finish his dissertation soon, I know. David, if he keeps working, his staff will be a little slower, but I will hang around for that.
But anyway.
But this has led me to think back over my career a little bit, and I think it is true that the basic question that I have always been interested in all my books is how change happens. I mean, you know, how do things change, and who creates change, and, you know, and why does it succeed at some points and it doesn't succeed at other points? That's what interests me in studying history. And so, yeah, Lincoln is in the same boat, in other words, a different level. Lincoln is at a totally different level than these Underground Railroad people, but it's all about what are the circumstances and processes that, you know, and actions of people that produce social change, you know? So Underground Railroad people did not end slavery. And the number of people who escaped, I estimate, this is a guess, 1,000 a year out of the South. 1,000 a year. There were 4 million slaves in 1860. So this is not destroying the institution of slavery, but the fugitive slave issue became a major catalyst of the sectional crisis and the coming of the Civil War. And so these people actually had a pretty powerful impact on events.
Mm-hmm. And thinking about your career as a whole, too, a point that was brought home to me when I was reading the book is both discussion of like how change is affected, but also the centrality of the African-American experience in the United States and your work as a whole, like going back to your first work. And even, I brought this along for visual aid purposes, the story of American freedom, the first image of it is of a civil rights demonstration in Orangeburg. Right, you're making a very strong statement about what freedom is.
Holding a sign that just says freedom.
Yeah.
That's all, one word, freedom. And that struck me, this person didn't feel it needed to be explained what she was, you know, what is this that somehow people would know, whereas I thought you needed a whole book to explain what it was. But yeah, I mean, you know, I grew up, as you know, in what they call an old left family in the 1950s. And this, you know, that whatever one's criticisms, which one can certainly develop of the old left, the Communist Party left, one of the things they absolutely insisted on was the centrality of the black experience in America, and that racism was, you know, the fundamental problem of American society in some ways. And this was not a popular idea at the time they were putting that forward. Later on, it became much more mainstreamed in the academic world, you know. But, you know, who invented African-American history in the first place? It was either black scholars, many of them, or white communists like my uncle or Herbert Aptheker, or I could name, you know, others who focused in on the black experience as central at a time when it was completely ignored in the mainstream university. So I learned that. W. Du Bois was a friend of my family. Paul Robeson was a friend of my family. I met these people when I was very young. I didn't obviously know what the heck, you know. There's a picture my mother had, I don't know what happened to it, of me on the shoulders of Paul Robeson when I was 2 years old. And he was a big guy. But, you know, so this was just second nature. I just absorbed that idea that the black question, the black experience, race in America was absolutely central. And then, of course, I was in college and graduate school in the 60s, and the civil rights revolution was taking place in the streets. And then I was lucky enough to have a great, great teacher. Nobody here remembers him. He's, you know, James Shenton at Columbia, legendary. But he also, he had assigned Du Bois' Black Reconstruction in the seminar. The chairman of the department told him not to do that. Called him in and said, you shouldn't. But he said, no, you, I'm applying that, you know, that book. But, you know, so Shenton also insisted that we had to study this. So, yeah, so I do think that this, you know, this has been pretty important in all of my work, but trying to put it in a context. I don't consider myself a scholar of African-American history. I just consider myself an American historian. This is a central part of American history. It's not the whole thing by any means, but it is a central part. But I try to, you know, even my book on Reconstruction, which makes blacks a central actors, also has a lot of other actors in there also.
But, yeah, I mean, if you're encountering the civil rights movement at the end of the 50s and through the 60s, it seems like there's another, tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I see a different kind of legacy in your scholarship, which is a concern for citizenship and for politics, or the concerns of that moment in the civil rights movement working themselves.
Well, you know, that's an interesting, I think you can't write a book review of your own book, you know. So, and I don't know that I can write my own intellectual history, but I think in an odd way, my works somehow reflect these two influences that shaped me. One is my family background, and the other is Richard Hofstadter, who I worked with as an undergraduate and then supervised my PhD dissertation, and these Hofstadter questions about politics, about political culture, political ideas, how they're related to society. This is what has shaped much of my writing, you know, or it's, but I'm doing it in a different way than Hofstadter. Hofstadter couldn't have cared less about, you know, social movements like this, really. He, in fact, he was frightened of them. He had been in the Communist Party briefly in the late 30s, but by the 60s, he was very, like many liberals, he had become, this is your book, of course, he had become very frightened of popular politics as being irrational, you know, the paranoid style, and he felt there was anti-Semitism just under the surface in a lot of these movements, the populists and all this. I thought he totally exaggerated that, but... So he was not interested in those kinds of things, except to denounce them. Whereas coming out of the 60s, I was much more interested in seeing who, you know, how social movements had actually produced change.
And this brings me to a question where I think this says something about your approach as a scholar and as a teacher that I've known you for a while, I've read your work, and I didn't know the answer to either of these questions. The first is, would you self-identify as a liberal? And the second is, would you self-identify as a Marxist?
I would not self-identify as a liberal. My very good friend. By the way,
what can say? All right.
My very good friend Steve Hahn, in his book *A Nation Under Our Feet*,
he calls you.
In the introduction, you always say how everyone else has been wrong and you're right. I do that myself. I do that in this book. Hans said, you know, I'm challenging the liberal integrationist history of this period. Footnote. Me, Eric Holmes. So I sent him an email. I said, you know, Hans, you really know how to hurt a guy. I don't mind being called an integrationist. I am an integrationist.
He's thinking you and LK and you and Malcolm.
Right. That's exactly what he was. Right, because he's exactly what he was doing. But I don't want to be called a liberal. Liberal integration. Integrationist is fine. I don't even know why. But and are you a Marxist? I don't. You know, what do these terms mean nowadays? Marx said, I'm not a Marxist, supposedly. I don't know. In other words, I don't think that's a... I have been very, very strongly influenced by a certain strand of Marxist writing, but particularly the British, you know, the Western Marxist kind of writing that came out in the 60s with the Hobsbawms and the Thompsons and others in England. I was powerfully influenced by that, and I think it has shaped encountering that literature, which I did after I got my PhD, because it wasn't taught at Columbia at that time. Powerfully shaped a lot of my writing, but there's a lot of other things that have shaped it. Although my colleague Alice Kessler Harris would not agree with this, I think I'm a feminist writer also. I'm very interested in women's movements and the gender issue at various points and how it has shaped, you know, how radical movements try to deal with that. So yes and no, in other words. Yeah, I'm a Marxist in the sense I'm powerfully influenced by Marx, but I'm influenced by a lot of other things also. But I think today these labels are so amorphous or so ill-defined that it's kind of hard to... Sometimes people ask me this even, you know, on TV, someone asks me, I said, well, what's a Marxist? Tell me what a Marxist is, and then I'll tell you if I'm a Marxist. And of course the pundit, you know, the guy couldn't begin to answer that, so we moved on to something else.
As will I.
But today I certainly don't consider myself a liberal. Absolutely not. And we were talking about this before. My view is liberalism has been... Liberalism today has become a lifestyle accoutrement, you know? And it is focused on issues which are not unimportant in any way, but they're mostly issues of... that the economic content of liberalism has washed out. You can be called... I mean, Mayor Bloomberg, when he ran, said, I'm a liberal. Remember, he was the only guy in politics. He was so rich he could say anything he wanted. He was the only guy in politics who was willing to take the label of liberal. But what is his liberalism? If you hate unions, you are opposed to, you know...
Way back to the 19th century liberalism.
Well, it's this lifestyle liberalism. It's the liberalism of gay rights, which is fine. Today, in the 1930s, you could be a liberal and a total racist. I mean, many, you know, many Southern New Dealers voted for every economic measure of the New Deal, as our friend Katz Nelson shows, who's been working, you know, but they were total racists. But that was not, your views on race were not part of what made you a liberal or not. Today, you can be called a liberal and have nothing to do with trade union issues, with minimum wage issues, with inequality. But if you're, you know, Lloyd Blankfein is in favor of gay marriage, so people think he's a liberal. So I'm not criticizing the people who fight for gay marriage, but God knows, I signed an amicus brief in the recent Supreme Court decision about this. But I think liberalism has lost its 20th century economic context.
This is a complaint I think that you hear a lot, is that, like, you could say since the 60s that the left has advanced, like, pretty far along in the cultural front while receding on economic issues.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's been said many times. I don't want to join the Todd Gitlins of this world, you know, just that's been on my mind lately. You know, just, you know, that, well, I won't even say it because maybe someone else. Everything has gone down the drain since he was president of SDS. What I would like to see is liberalism expanded to include these kinds of issues. These are important issues which were not dealt with by previous generations of liberals, but to substitute one for the other, which I think is what has happened in contemporary liberalism, is not, you know, liberalism has no vocabulary today to talk about the economic crisis this country is facing.
And this question about the mutability of liberalism, I think, is really at the core of, like, a lot of your work, and you see it, among other things, in The Story of American Freedom, which is about how this ideology expands, contracts, shifts at different points. But something, when I was rereading it today, or just looking over again today, I was struck by, I'd forgotten that the last chapter is just conservative freedom. Like, there's not, like, a conclusion, it just, like, ends dropping you off in, like, Reagan-era America, like, right. Reagan's America.
Yeah, well, you know, that book is a kind of oddball book. I wanted that, I mean, that book is the remnant, in a way, of a book I was going to write and never did, which is A History of American Radicalism, which I was going to write in the 70s, and then the Reconstruction invitation came and derailed me from that. But, you know, and in a way, I'm glad I didn't write that, because this is more centrally focused on me. But, you know, it's an attempt to give people a usable past. Now, it was written in the 90s. It was written at a time when, you know, it was written before 9/11. Now, I should write another chapter on
this. This is what I was going to ask you. If you were writing, an updated version, like,
if I ever get around to it and have the energy, I will, because the way freedom was usurped and used, you know, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and Bush and all this, and then the whole issue of civil liberties nowadays and the Patriot Act. I mean, I think the whole debate over freedom has taken some very interesting turns since that book was written. But I wanted it to be a book that people who are, how shall I put this? The people who read Howard Zinn, I also wanted to read that book. Howard was a good friend of mine, and I think it's great people read his book, but I think there are a lot of problems with his book as history. And this book is a sort of, I wanted it to complement it and say, no, you know, look, let's think about this as a more complicated issue than just people rising up and being smashed down. That's American history, according to Zinn, people rising up and getting smashed down all the time. And actually, to me, that's very pessimistic. If that's the history for 300 years, why should people do it? Where, as I said, I'm kind of an optimist. I'm interested in people who actually accomplish change, and how they went about doing it, not the people who just were smashed down by the state. I don't know. I kind of like that book, but I don't think, I like the fact you called it intellectual history, because no intellectual historian thinks that. It has made no impact whatsoever on intellectual historians, which, in a way, it's fair enough, because I don't really think of myself as an intellectual historian, but it's sort of a social history of an idea. And a very, very central idea in American political discourse, you know. And I don't think we, whether the left or even liberals, should cede the idea of freedom to the right, which is what has happened in the last generation.
And I want to open it up for questions after this, but just one last, if I can. So we've been talking about sort of the importance of African American history in your work so far, your engagement with the civil rights movement from the start of your career. I wonder, just like looking at Baltimore, looking at Ferguson, Black Lives Matter, when you see them today, does it seem like something new? Does it seem like a retread of the 1970s?
Well, the trouble with historians is we have a long memory, and nothing has ever seems new, you know? Racism is not new. Police brutality is not new. As I was reading somewhere today, every major riot or uprising, whatever you want to call it, since the 60s, except for the ones when Martin Luther King was shot, have all been triggered by police, you know, police actions of one kind or another, police actions against black people. So this is not new, right? This happened 50 years ago in the 60s, and even before that. But the danger of leaving it at that is, you know, the whole configuration of the society has changed. We are not back in the 60s. We are not back in the Reconstruction era. We are not back in the slavery era. One has to sort of really make an analysis of how racism functions today, especially in a society where a significant number of black people have been absorbed into the upper classes. You know, not a majority, but a significant, there never has been, until now, a significant number of black people at, you know, in major corporate jobs, universities certainly.
No, Mayor of Baltimore and police chief in Baltimore.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so it's not quite the same as in the era of segregation, obviously. Or even the, you know, in the early civil rights era. We have to have an analysis which which looks at the structures today. The face of racism today is not, putting a policeman aside, is not Bull Connor, you know, with his dogs. It's a guy in a three-piece suit. I'm not accusing you of racism. It's a Wells Fargo banker in a three-piece suit who is shuttling black home buyers into subprime mortgages, as they did. That's what racism is today. It is not. In fact, the whole question of police brutality is obviously central, but it is not particularly what racism is. Most racism is not being done by people who are shooting other people, you know? Or was it Woody Guthrie said, some people rob you with a six gun and some with a fountain pen. It's the guys with the fountain pens, if there are such things anymore, who are actually perpetuating racial inequality in this country more than it's the blank farms of this world. And many others like that, right? And that's the kind of analysis we need, as well as the analysis of the criminal justice system and everything, which is coming out now after Ferguson and Baltimore.
With that, open it up to the audience.
What do you think is the concept of freedom that has been ceded by the left to the right, pre-mentioned?
I think the word freedom has been ceded. The left doesn't talk about freedom very much, in my observation. It should, I think, or even within the political realm. Now, when in, I guess it was 2008, a former student of mine who was working for Hillary Clinton's campaign gave me a call and said, Mrs. Clinton is looking for ideas for her speeches. Well, do you have any thoughts, you know? I said, yeah, I have a thought. My thought is she should talk about freedom. She should say freedom is not just getting the government off your back, owning a gun, you know, and that, which is what people think it is today. And talk about more positive views of freedom and, you know, freedom as equality and opportunity and all sorts of things. So I think this goes back to the Cold War, where the free world versus the other world, and the way, you know, everything was in the name of freedom, all these depredations. So I think people on the left have become cynical and just unhappy with the concept, we're not in favor of freedom, but the word itself and the effort to associate with it, I think that's a big mistake. Obama, wherever one wants to put him on the political spectrum, doesn't actually talk about freedom very much. He talks about, this is one of the numerous crimes against humanity of Bush, is that he kind of discredited the idea of freedom for a while because of Iraq and everything. Obama doesn't talk about freedom except when he's going to war. Then it's freedom. We're fighting for freedom against ISIS, against these guys. We're bombing Somalia for freedom. You know, freedom is the last refuge of the scoundrel, you know, in wartime. But in domestic issues, the left should, we should talk about what, how you can't be free if you are living on a minimum wage or, you know, something like that. Because freedom is so central to Americans' conception of themselves and to our political language. The right talks about freedom all the time, and we don't. And I think we should, actually.
Did any of the characters you uncovered in your scholarship class, pre-war, pre-Civil War history, anticipate any of the ambiguities of a freedom based on wage labor?
I'm sorry, the ambiguities of?
A freedom based on wage labor.
Oh, well, I've written about that. That's a very important issue because, you know, in the abolitionist movement before the Civil War and the very small, the vocal labor movement of that time debated this very vehemently. There was, I don't want to give you a long history, you know, my tendency is to now go back and talk about David Bryan Davis and Thomas Hanson, but I won't.
Good PowerPoint.
But, you know, the abolitionists unintentionally, probably, helped to valorize wage labor by isolating slave labor as the epitome of illegitimate labor coercion, right? And slaves, you know, Frederick Douglass, he escaped through New York, came here, went up to New Bedford, Massachusetts. He writes in his autobiography, he got a job working on the docks as a ship caulker, that's what he'd done in Baltimore. At the end of his first week, he got paid. And he said, for the first time in my life, I was truly free because I received a wage. So the abolitionist movement sees the ability to earn wages as an emblem of freedom. The labor movement talks about wage slavery. They talk about the oppression involved in the wage relationship, the inequality involved in the wage system, and how people have to get out of it. Now, they don't know quite how to. Some people say, let's get land in the West, you know, or let's set up cooperative production, or whatever, you know, a cooperative commonwealth. But the question of whether working for wages makes you free or a slave was debated very vigorously at that time. And in some ways, you know, one of the arguments of my book on Reconstruction after the Civil War is that this is the crisis where the notion that to be free you have to actually own property is abandoned. Because the former slaves are free, they are 4 million people, but they are not given land, as we all know, 40 acres and a mule. And the Republican Party, which had risen to power as the spokesman of free labor, now concludes that you can be free without property. As a wage earner, you are still free. And that, I think, is a shift in a lot of discourse from before the Civil War. But the labor movement keeps trying to make that, that's in this book, The Story of American Freedom, the labor movement becomes the inheritor of the idea that to work for wages, you're not truly free, and into the late 19th century. And, you know, and then that flows into the socialist movement in the early 20th century. It lasts a long, long time. But so, yes, that debate has been of great interest to me in a lot of my writing.
So I have a question that's sort of specific to the time period in your book. You touched on it very briefly, the creation of the African Free School, which was a kind of project of the Manumission Society.
Right.
John Jay is involved in it. I'm not a historian or scholar of history, but I keep feeling like I haven't actually found much good historical work specifically on the African Free School.
The African Free School of New York City is a fascinating subject, and somebody should. There is a very old book from that period written about it. There are some works on the New York Manumission Society. This has been on my mind lately, oddly enough, because, among other things, even though I'm only teaching half time, I'm busier than ever, because I'm doing about 15 different things. And one of them is supervising a project studying Columbia University's historical connection to slavery. And there may be an article about this in the New York Times in the next few days, so keep your eyes open. Stephen Porter came and interviewed us all. Columbia, as King's College, was founded by slave traders. I mean, that's where the money was in the 18th century in New York. Merchants who traded with the West Indies, traded with Africa, they all owned slaves, they dealt with slaves, they dealt with sugar, the products of slave labor. All the early presidents owned slaves, faculty owned slaves, you know, one or two working, there's not a plantation system. But then you have these Columbians like John Jay, Hamilton, Grutter Morris, and others who formed the New York Manumission Society in 1785 to get the gradual abolition of slavery in New York. But one could go into that. But what's interesting about them, they also set up the African Free School. This is before the colonization movement. They assume these freed slaves are going to be part of American society. They're not saying they have to go somewhere else. They will be here. They better be educated then. You can't be a citizen without being educated. So they actually set up this free school, and a lot of the black leadership of 19th century New York comes out of the African free schools, James McCune Smith, many, many others. And eventually there's six or seven of them. In the 1830s, they're absorbed into the New York City public school system, and I don't actually know what happens to them after that. It'd be interesting to know. But they're a very interesting, they show, these early, early manumissionists are usually considered rather genteel. They are, they're very rich. They're totally contradictory. For example, they won't let blacks as members of the manumission society. They said, we must speak for these black people. But, you know, they go out of their way to help them. They do accomplish a lot. And, they're often contrasted with the radical abolitionists of later, in some ways correctly, but I think you have to give them credit in a slave-based city for actually agitating to get rid of slavery, even though some of them owned slaves. John Jay owned slaves when he was president of the New York Manumission Society. There's no contradiction, because manumission was a voluntary act of freeing your slave, and they try to encourage that. Eventually, they got a law to gradually end slavery. So, yeah, the African free schools could use some good, serious analysis. No question about it.
Okay, Jeff. You talked about maybe particularly some of your recent work, maybe all of your work, as dealing with the sort of usable past, and that seems like actually a good example. But I was curious if, given recent events, you thought there were particular historical episodes or themes that you focused on recently that you wish were more part of the conversation, or you wish would be taken up and explored further?
Well, you know, I think the problem is nobody knows any history in this country, despite our
best hands. After tonight, it all changes.
This room accepted. But, I have a vested interest in arguing that we should know more about the Reconstruction period. A lot of what we are talking about today in the society has roots in Reconstruction, whether it's citizenship or, you know, racism or economic inequality and how to deal with it and many, many other questions. I think we ought to actually, this is an unpopular view maybe, I think we ought to be thinking more also about the progressive era and particularly the old Socialist Party. I would like to have the old Socialist Party back. Because I've talked about it before, you cannot view this through the Russian Revolution and World War I backwards. You know what I mean? Nobody in 1912 knew the Russian Revolution and World War I was on the horizon. Just as in 1850 they didn't know the Civil War was 10 years ahead. And the Socialist Party, although, you know, again, people, it's kind of amorphous and, you know, kind of wishy-washy in a lot of ways. But it was an umbrella for all these different, I mean, Emma Goldman was in there for a while, Du Bois was in there for a while, labor unions were in there for, you know, there were people, they were radical literary figures connected with all sorts of different people, feminists, women suffragists. It was a kind of a large house, which all these people could find some role in under this rubric, ill-defined, obviously, of socialism. It had to be ill-defined because there was no society in the world at that time that was claimed to be socialist. But that gave it a lot of freedom. And, it was part of the political discourse. And today, we have a lot of movements today, but there doesn't seem to be any uniting kind of impulse the way existed there. I know there are plenty of reasons to criticize the old Socialist Party, and there are many of them, including Debs, who prioritized certain economic issues and kind of said all the rest are unimportant. You know, like we don't have a black policy because blacks are workers and we just have a workers. Well, the liberation of the working class will liberate black people, so we don't have to talk about race. Debs supposedly said that. I don't know if he said it or not, but the critics say it. But so there were problems, but on the other hand, I think the notion of a common ideal or aspiration, which people of all sorts of different particular interests can adhere to, is to me very appealing.
Well, it's been an hour, and I think we can continue this conversation over drinks afterwards. But before, I mean, this line, this question about models we can draw from the past reminds me about this line I dug up when I was like reading your books earlier. It's from an introduction to your book on politics and ideology, Native Civil War, where you said that history teaches few easy lessons, but it should assist us to think creatively about ourselves, which I think you have a massive body of scholarship attesting to, and that this magazine at its best lives up to, which is why it's appropriate that you were here today.
I'm happy to be here.
So, and I wanted to again, thank you, thank Natasha.
By the way, actually, my father would have been appalled. But that is a different generation.
I guess, three times.
I've contributed on occasion, yeah. Well, I have... That's right. You have, I should complain to you about that.
It was a little before my
wasn't
time.
It in, yeah, that's right. I blame you. Yeah, wasn't it in Descent where Genovese...
Yeah.
Alice, Harris, and me being the agents of Stalin. He forgot
even
Stalin
about
30 years ago. Yeah. Something along those lines. But yeah, okay, so it's a pretty big...
Well, this is even right, Moses, before you were born, and a betting for show.
I've
been
adding denunciations of communists before I was born.
Yeah, something, right, that's right. No, but I hold no animus against Descent whatsoever. I promise. I admire it, so I hope long may it wait.
On that note, lack of hostility.